We're back this week again with the Infectious Disease Hour, broadcast out of Atlanta, Georgia, in the United States. This week we have a very exciting guest, Mr. Gregory Hartl, with the World Health Organization. Welcome, Mr. Hartl.
Hello, thank you very much.
I guess we should start explaining about what the World Health Organization does and what's it a part of, and then what you do with the World Health Organization.
Okay, thank you very much. So the World Health Organization is the specialized agency within the United Nations which deals with health. So basically, we try to help developing countries above all, but all countries, but really we concentrate on developing countries, improve their health systems and the ability to deliver good health care to their peoples. So our objective is to attain the highest possible levels of health for the world's people. That's a huge task, and obviously there's a long way to go in many areas, but that's why we were founded. So within WHO, I work on epidemic and pandemic diseases, so stretching from very small little outbreaks of potentially very deadly diseases like Ebola up to big diseases or that can affect millions of people, such as the pandemic influenza. And I'm the lead of the communications team for these diseases.
Well, I thank you for participating with us today, because I think it's really important to get the word out about what you do. And of course, we have a lot of students listening to us, so we like to sometimes, you and I spoke about 6 or 7 months ago, but sometimes we like to go over some of that territory to new people who are logging in or downloading these podcasts. So the membership of WHO is open to anyone who's also a member of the United Nations, and that would be about, 193 countries?
Yes, we have 193 member states, that's it, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And the WHO agenda, basically, I can just sort of, it's on the website, and anyone can log into the WHO website. It's who.int, check out any of the resources that you've got there. And basically, the WHO agenda is promoting development, fostering health security, strengthening health systems, harnessing research information and evidence, enhancing partnerships, and improving performance. And so that would really be such a broad, that's basically everything, isn't it?
It's extremely broad.
Well, of course, what we're here to really discuss today is, I guess we have two flu strains on the pandemic charts at this time. One is the novel H1N1, which we have at a level 6, and then one we have H5N1 at level 3. I guess we'll start with H1N1. What is your assessment of what's going on right now?
Well, certainly we have seen that in general activity with H1N1 has decreased around the world. And this is something which would signal that we might be past the worst. And in fact, next week, what's called the Emergency Committee of one of our formal legal mechanisms is meeting to decide whether or not we should consider that we are actually past the peak, and it's called going into the post-peak phase. It doesn't mean that the pandemic's over, but it means that likely there won't be as much activity again as we saw in the late end of last year in the Northern Hemisphere.
What criteria does WHO take into account in order to lower the alert level? Would that be like backing down? Is there a phase 7, or do you go back to a 5? And what criteria is it considered?
Okay. We actually go forward. We don't actually go backwards. And what happens after phase 6, which is the highest phase, is then it is called post-peak, because it means that in all likelihood there are not going to be the kind of transmissions of the virus that we saw in phase 6 that we are seeing or that we saw towards the end of 2009. But it still means that the virus is behaving like a pandemic virus rather than a seasonal virus. So what does it mean when it's a pandemic virus? It means that it can cause substantial amounts of illness outside of normal influenza season, and that we can still see it cause large numbers of disease, at least in limited locations, quite suddenly, because it can hit a group of people that otherwise isn't immune to it, because this is still a virus which hasn't circulated for long enough for the basically enough people to have immunity to it so that the virus doesn't circulate easily.
For instance, you know, we have gotten almost no information out of Africa. Are you hearing anything out of Africa except for southern Africa, or, and of course, Egypt? We've gotten quite a bit of information, but in the broad sense of Africa, you know, we feel like we haven't really seen what's going on there.
Yeah, Africa is difficult because surveillance systems in Africa are, of course, not as well developed as they are in Europe or North America or certain parts of Asia. So it's much more difficult to know exactly what's going on there. Although we are now more or less sure, more sure than we were before, that we think that Western Africa, for example, is starting to see some influenza activity, indigenous transmission of the virus, whereas we hadn't seen that before in Africa.
If, you know, a lot of people use the 1918 pandemic experience as a model, potentially, for this pandemic. So if we see a third wave, would we expect that to be milder? A lot of places are not testing anymore. You know, they don't have the kits, or it's too time-consuming, or there were too many cases, and they've just, you know, I think the U.S. estimate is hugely, hugely broad, 60 million to 80-something million potential. And, you know, most majority of those people never, never, never got tested, of course. And
yeah.
So, for instance, in the United States, we've seen a little bit of an uptick in influenza-like illnesses, but not a lot of testing. Could we assume that a lot of that, you know, and if you extrapolate for the world, a lot of that might be H1N1 that's undetected, or we don't quite know?
We really don't know. I don't think it's easy to extrapolate. First of all, just to step back to the beginning, it's expensive to test. And so after a certain amount of time, all governments will stop testing, because if they know that they have the virus there, then something looks like and walks like and talks like influenza, they don't need to test for it anymore. So that they can pretty much already jump to the next step, which is treating severe cases. So a lot of times what will happen is that, you know, if someone hasn't been immunized, vaccinated against H1N1, then you watch their symptoms, and if they have symptoms that persist and have high fever for more than 3 days, for example, then you would start them on oseltamivir or another antiviral. You don't need laboratory confirmation of this, and you probably won't consequently see many more lab tests being done.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you know, the rest of the world is like the United States, you know, I said we had an uptick in ILI, but really it's sort of in one area we'll have an uptick and then someplace else doesn't have anything. And then at the same time, some of our pneumonia cases, the severe pneumonia cases, look like they've gotten a little bit worse. So it's just really hard to put a real finger on what's going on.
Well, yeah, I think what they have been finding, I mean, first of all, let's say, you know, what you've said about the U.S. is almost like a microcosm of the rest of the world, in the sense that activity can be very different from one area to another within the same country. And obviously, so it goes for within a country and on a global basis. You can have a lot of activity in one city or in one country, and then in the neighbor city or neighbor country, you don't have anything. It appears to be the case. Oh, sorry. And then another thing that probably would want to say is that certain parts of the U.S. and Canada, maybe, and certain parts of the U.K. and Spain. Spain were probably much worse hit than other parts of the world, from what we can tell. Now, if you go back to the question about ILI, yes, in general, the percentage of viruses which test positive for H1 as a subset of all ILI viruses does seem to be declining at the moment, but it's still out there. I mean, it's not hard and fast what you do with this disease.
Exactly. In countries where the vaccine acceptance has been low, even some European countries and really pretty much the United States, would you expect a third wave of this illness to get a better hold?
It's really difficult to say. I don't think anyone would stake their reputation on that question. And it's going to depend. You know, if the virus mutates, it could cause a third wave, because then not all of a sudden it would mean that in effect no one has immunity to the virus. But if the virus stays the same, we probably on the whole will not see the kind of big outbreaks that we saw last year.
If we talk about severity, of course, this disease went for the younger age groups than seasonal flu, and of course it also has a nasty side, or in particular age groups or particular pre-existing conditions. It would go straight to people's lungs, and this made it very difficult for those individuals to recover. And sometimes they would go in just a few days. You know, if this was particularly bad for them. And heroic efforts, all kinds of machinery didn't save them. And so, of course, out there on the Internet and I think in the mainstream media, there's a lot of speculation that, of course, there's a worse strain that's out there, and or certain mutations have occurred that are more dangerous than what most people experienced, and those are out there causing more severe illness. Do you see a mutated strain that's causing more severe illness, particularly that goes for the lungs or causes multi-organ failure at all anywhere?
The great majority of viruses that we've seen, picked up by the Global Influenza Surveillance Network, for example, are quite similar to the original virus.
Okay, and so I guess in part of Eastern Europe this year there was some talk about a strain that was more potentially deadly than another strain, and what was that, just media hype, or I know they were having some elections in that part of the world. Was that any part of making this look like it was more dangerous or not? I'm just trying to understand just generally, is there any part of this virus that's dangerous, that looks like it's spreading anywhere that we would want to pay attention to?
Well, I don't have a lot of particulars about the Ukraine or Eastern European situation. If we remember when the virus first appeared and before it was actually identified as a new virus, there were a lot of mooted cases of this in Mexico, and everything was being thrown in. So it's quite common, actually, when there is something unknown and when there is a personal threat to someone's person, that there's a strong reaction. And this strong reaction can translate into it being ascribed as to be the cause of a lot of different things. But I really think at the end of the day, the virus is, as what we've seen scientifically, is that the virus is quite similar everywhere around the world. It really hasn't mutated much yet.
Mm-hmm. The new vaccine targets, I think, were published today, And in there, of course, it looks like the H1N1 vaccine is going to be part of the trivalent, yes?
Well, it's going to be part of the seasonal vaccine for the upcoming Northern Hemisphere winter, the 2010-2011 winter. It is up to each national authority then to decide whether they want to make the three strains into a trivalent vaccine or whether they want a monovalent and a bivalent vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Is that... One thing that always confuses me is it says, you know, H3N2-like or H1N1-like. Does that mean this California part, is this the original seed strain from last year, or is this a newer, H1N1 novel seed because it's like, or is it the same exact one?
Yeah, so what happens is that the when it says California-like, the California 2009 is the original virus, the first viruses that were isolated in California last year from the first cases, which I believe were two teenage children or young children in any case. What happens is that as long as you have a very similar virus which reacts the same way when you are creating the antigen in the process of virus production, you can use that exact same virus or a very similar virus. But the idea is that you want to protect against viruses which are similar or identical to the California 2009 virus.
Right. So the actual virus that's the California 2009-like may not be the exact seed from last year. It may be a newer model from a few months ago, a couple months ago. By the time they get it together, could be one from now.
Yeah, that's my understanding, yes. But, the main thing is just to make sure that the vaccine virus that you use protects against the most common circulating strain.
Right. So if they've picked up, because of course, these viruses drift and they do all these things. So whatever was circulating exactly last April may not be the exact thing that's circulating now. And so they might use a more current circulating sample strain to make the monovalent or the part of the trial, however anyone the states want to do it. It would be the California 09 representation.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, that's a comforting thought, because there was some speculation this morning about that on the Internet.
Okay.
So, I just wanted to nail that down. That's why, it's so great that you'll talk to us so that and people get a comfort level and they can, you're like a real voice, a real person, talking, and you laugh and, you do all the things that everybody normal does. Sometimes people get an idea these institutions are sort of scary, building-looking kind of things, and you don't really know what's going on there.
Right.
Well, all right, let's go to H5N1. It's from my perspective, and of course, we track a lot of diseases, and of course, we track these flus, that, for instance, in Egypt last year, they really were, having a fairly decent number of H1N1 confirmed cases. The Ministry of Health confirmed, and then WHO confirmed beyond that. And then we had the pandemic breakout, the H1N1 pandemic, and the WHO confirmed and Ministry of Health confirmed bird flu cases really diminished, and as a matter of numbers. Now we've gone, the beginning of this year, and we're seeing some more cases again now, the H5N1. Indonesia, I think you guys have one acknowledged on your chart, but I think the Ministry of Health came out yesterday and has it acknowledged two for this year. You guys will probably update your chart soon.
Mm-hmm.
What are you seeing at H5N1 around the world? Does anything bother you? Any parts of the world? In humans, of course, we know there's there's poultry endemic everywhere. But,
sure.
We haven't seen anything too much out of China, other Southeast Asia places. Is anything bothering you there? Are you seeing any kind of spread that is disturbing?
There's nothing which we really can point to. I mean, I think that obviously much less attention has been paid to H5N1 since the advent of H1N1. But H5N1 has really never disappeared, and you know, we do continue to see cases, and so it does need to be continue to be monitored. And I think, you know, attention will probably refocus on it as you know, H5N1 continues, and H5N1 does continue to be a threat which we have to watch closely, because there is the possibility that it, like all influenza viruses, will mutate.
Right. You know, so in places like, let's take Egypt, for example, where, you know, they have an endemic poultry problem since a long time, a history, I think, well, they've announced their 100th case today internally, and 99, I think, is official, but we have something from the Ministry of Health in Arabic that they've announced their 100th case.
Okay.
But then you have ongoing, of course, novel H1N1 there, too.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any concerns about, you know, the transmissibility of H1N1 somehow becoming part of H5N1, or some of the lethality of H5N1 becoming part of the H1N1?
Yes, I mean, that's something which has been mooted before, and, you know, is theoretically certainly possible. You know, and so in areas where both H1N1 and H5N1 circulate, we should be particularly vigilant.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I don't know how good these hospitals are in parts of the world that are keeping some of these patients apart. I don't know that how good the isolation wards are.
Fortunately, at the moment, there are so few H5N1 patients that it's not an issue in a lot of cases, but certainly it's something which should be kept in mind.
It looks like, at least in the Egyptian cases, of course, that every one of these people's had some kind of contact with poultry.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, while they do have, you know, a fairly decent number of H1N1 infections to report, these are, compared to the amount of poultry in the country, probably not too many, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, as you say, there's, well, both in Egypt and in Indonesia and in other places, there's huge, huge numbers of birds around. So, you know, and we have seen that the great majority, almost all cases of human infection have come from diseased birds. So the two go together.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, Egypt has, you know, is very strong, very conscientious policies or control measures in place.
Right, and it's just a matter of, I guess, remaining vigilant. What are do you know the latest efforts on an H5N1 vaccine? What's going on? I think you came out with something today.
Well, I don't think there was anything on H5N1 today, but in any case, certainly, you know, even before H1N1 appeared, the pandemic appeared, there were vaccines which for H5N1 which had been tested in the laboratory and were found to be reactive, that they caused an immune reaction in labs, but it's impossible to test these vaccines ethically before you actually have a pandemic, and you can't test it then you just want to give it to everyone. So I mean, that's basically where we are. There are certain vaccines which have been developed for H5N1, but they've really never been used.
Right. Well, there's I guess what I was referring to is, I think there's an update on your site.
From the cases in Egypt, maybe.
This, the WHO antigenic and genetic characteristics of influenza A, H5N1, and influenza A, H9N2 viruses and candidate vaccine viruses developed for potential use.
Yes, you're right. Yeah.
So I'm just glad that, you know, you all are watching that, because, again, it took about 6 months to get the H1N1 out from beginning.
It always takes approximately that length of time, because unfortunately the production process can't go any faster.
Right, right. There's newer technologies being developed, but those aren't full production yet, no?
Yeah, exactly. So by far the most widespread and the most used and best known of these production methods is based on culturing the virus in eggs.
Well, that gets me to another topic that's interesting too, is that I know that the vaccine is really probably the greatest public health tool in this pandemic, of course, or for any not just pandemic. I mean, look at polio, look at all the smallpox, et cetera, et cetera. So it's there's a history there. But for the countries that, if this had been a worse pandemic, some other countries would not have been selling or donating their excess capacity to other countries who didn't get orders in. And there's always been some talk about alternative, not alternative medicine, but maybe the use of off-label, like statins for flu. Do you all investigate any of these ideas, or are you pretty much sticking with vaccine theory?
Well, I think for the moment, let's say, it's always good that there's research into alternatives. Mm-hmm. The more alternatives we have of whatever type, the better. So, but I think the use of statins is very much still in the realm of research, and let's say its benefits are not yet really confirmed. Mm-hmm. So for us, yes, the best tool remains vaccines to prevent the disease, and certainly after the fact to treat the disease, antivirals.
I'm going to bring up sort of a passionate thing here now. And we came out very strong on this issue. It has to do with, I guess, some claims or accusations that WHO created this pandemic to sell vaccine or drugs or something, and was pushed through, inquiry was pushed through the Council of Europe, and, there was quite a spectacle from my viewpoint, and Dr. Fukuda, I guess, made an appearance and laid out WHO's position on declaring a pandemic for novel H1N1. Would you like to make some comment about this?
Yes, okay. Certainly, in our minds, there is no doubt that this is a pandemic. So the pandemic was caused by a virus to which most of humanity had no prior immunity. So it is a new virus. And it has spread to at least 212 countries and territories around the world. So it is a disease which has caused outbreaks and epidemics in literally every single country in the world. So how this could not be a pandemic is not disputable.
Right. Well, we came out very strong in support of WHO's declaration of a pandemic because I was very particularly upset personally. I have two children that are young adults right in the path of one of a novel virus pandemic. And, this is a time when many of the industrialized countries are rolling out vaccines. And, for this to be used, this claim to be perpetuated along, it was really ridiculous. It's an animal-based flu virus that is adapted to humans. And so clearly this would be something, if the World Health Organization was going to protect the world against something, this would certainly be one of those things,
Yeah, exactly.
And so, we came out very strong, and, as a consequence, I don't know if that particular event alone, but a lot of people did not bother to get the H1N1 vaccine in many, many countries. And, I'm not quite sure why. I think there's always these idea of, what's in them, et cetera, et cetera. But part of it is this kind of a claim. And I hope people look into their motivations when you're talking about public health like this. I've read an autopsy of someone who died, he was about 50 years old, and he was okay on Saturday, and he was dead on Thursday.
Yeah.
And he was a particular individual who was, I think he had a weight problem, and he was dead in 5 or 6 days. He didn't even think, he was that sick until, I think, Monday. He was sick on Saturday. Mm-hmm. On Monday, he finally seeked some medical help, and I think he was in ICU right away, and he was dead 2 or 3 days later. And if you've read one of these autopsies and realize that this person was walking around and totally normal the Friday before, you know, this isn't something that people should play around, especially when most of the countries have offered this vaccine for free or almost free. And it's a great tool in case you're one of the unlucky ones that this thing had was going to target. So, you know, again, for me personally, to have young adult children in this age group that seem to be targeted by this virus, I was particularly not appreciative of, you know, of those public message going out anyway.
Sure. No, I think WHO would very much feel the same. Again, you know, it's how would you prevent an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So, and what we would say in general is that we owe it to the world to be prepared and help the world be as prepared as possible. And if at the end of the day something doesn't turn out as badly as it could have, then everyone would turn around and say, or should turn around and say, well, at least thank God. Well, that was a close call. Thank God we missed it. Whereas it's like, you know, you think of it's like a hurricane, that everyone prepares for a hurricane before it comes, and you board up your house and you get out of town, and you'd much rather take all those actions beforehand and then be happy when the hurricane doesn't hit your house than the reverse, where you don't do anything, the hurricane destroys your house, and, you know, you lose everything. So
I agree. I think who is in a much better position to have sounded the alert and maybe made, you know, and people made too much vaccine or ordered too much vaccine than to have it in the reverse? I can't even imagine what that furor would be look like, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So
who
I think
said, oh, don't worry about this. It's not killing that many people, you know, and then not pursue a vaccine and not pursue an aggressive policy and then have it really ratchet up higher.
Mm.
I think that would not have been such a great situation. Normally in the middle like this, what I do is I thank everyone on our site that volunteers, and you know, we're carried and viewed in, I think the latest count was 150 something, I don't know, countries every month. We publish in 5 languages every day, and we publish also in an additional 4 or 5 languages intermittently. And many of these are scientists and also moms and people from all over the world that gather this information. So I always take a minute to thank everyone, and I'll make my list now. Anu Don, Alaska Denise, Alert, Amish Country, Anahata, Andy 2000, Ann, Auntie, Apple Blossom, ARR309, BC, Black Nail, Blue, Carol RN, Kanika, Kartsky, Kelvin 11, Chuck, Color My Quilt, Common Ground, Corn, Dark Horse, Daisy, David Fedson, Dr. JJ, Dutchy, E.R. McGarry, Emily, English Teacher, Estacion, Evelyn, Farmer, Florida Medic, Flubasi, Flu Freak, Frenchy Girl, Ganderspell, Ginny F., German Doctor, GS47, GSGS, Grattan Woodson, Greg Dworkin, Ghost RN, Harpsong, Hawkeye, Henry N., High Risk, Hogweed, Hornblower, I Am Robertson, Ilchiberg, Inky, Ironer Hopper, James S., Janet May, Jeremy, Jet Stubby, Jim O., Jay Jackson, John Barry, Jonesy, KBD, KD, Kent Nickel, Kiwi Bird, Laidback Al, Legadillo, Lily, Liz W., El Monte, LR Frigo, Lero, Mikado, Mama Bird, Mathematician, Melly, MHSC, Michelle Marier, Ming, Mingus, Missouri Watcher, Mixon, ModTech, Morning Person, Mother Abigail, Muscad, Nancy, Nika, Nico, North 44, NS1, Nurse Naltz, Okimon, Oric, Pam 41, Pathfinder, P Flu, PGIA2, Possibilities, Prep Deb, Quiplesh, Ready Mom, Revere, Richard McSee, Roll JC, Roro, Ruth Bimi, Sally, Sarah Smiles, S. Brooks, Science Teacher, Scott McPherson, Shannon, Sharp, Shiloh, Siam, Silver Girl, Snickle Fritz, Somebody Out There, Sophie Zoe, St. Michael, Steve Osteen, Susan Chu, Susie M., M. Modesto, T., The Foreigner, Tesseract, Teresa 42, Thornton, Tropical Girl, True Scotsman, Toaster 2, Tonka, Trayfish, Tropical, Tual, Taito, Unpathed Haunt, Vibrant 62, WD Care, Wet Dirt, Yield Dude, Zach, Zakermis, Zima Girl, and there's others. And I list them all because a lot of those are scientists and other people that, you know, they don't want to post in their real name, but they put a lot of studies on the site and things that really do help people. And we hear from all around the world in remote places that they've logged on and gotten some kind of a hint or a tip or a paper they were able to download. And so, and our Google rating is fairly decent. So we do actually provide a lot of information. It's all these volunteers from all over the world. You know, we're a nonprofit that do this for us. And so I always take some time and thank them. And I know the list sounds a little bit strange, but that's, I guess, how it is. I want to also ask you now about this whole idea of sequences. People talk about sequence of, you know, flu or whatever, and researchers will, you know, get a grant, and then they do some work, and then they generate these samples, and a lab will sequence it for them, and then these sequences disappear into oblivion somewhere. And can you explain who's, do you have sequences in some special WHO vault of sequences? What happens when, you know, you guys get involved in a case, let's say in Egypt, and sequences are sent to you? Are multiple sequences sent out all over? Can you give shed any light on what goes on in this scenario?
Unfortunately, that's really outside my area of expertise. I wish I could.
Okay, because there's always talk about sequences here and there, and I'm always not quite clear of where they all are or what happens
right.
to them.
Right. No, we'd have to ask someone who's more of a specialist on the lab side.
Mm-hmm.
What happens with that?
There are WHO labs, though, right?
No, there are collaborating centers. We mm-hmm. don't have any labs ourselves.
Okay.
So we rely basically on the collaboration of other labs who are willing to share their information.
Okay. So you're not, you know, what's interesting from our perspective is then some things are at Genbank, some things are at some place called Mill Hill in England. Then there's GSID. GSID has some things, and it's not really clear to me how this all works in the big scheme of things.
Yeah, sorry, it's not an area that I really deal with that much. So unfortunately, it's not something that I'm going to be able to elucidate for you.
Oh, okay. Because it's just sort of an unknown. It's an unclear to me.
Sure.
When a country calls and asks for your help, what's the protocol? What do you do if a country thinks that they have a, you know, an infectious disease or any kind of a issue? What happens? Do they call, and then how do you guys respond?
They basically will perhaps contact us via their national focal point or disease specialists, or it might come via the country office, because, you know, we have offices in 150 countries with. And the head of office is supposed to be the main point of contact with each country. And so often, you know, obviously it's the person in the country who knows the people in the country best. And so that person would act as the liaison between the country and us, so that the request can get directed in the right direction.
Right. And then what do you do? Assemble a team and go? If it's deemed that you might want one or two people on the ground, how do you
Yeah, we would assemble a team either from people inside, or we would call in outside experts. We have what's called the Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network, and that allows us to call on experts in various disciplines from around the world. And, you know, among the rosters of experts, we can usually find someone who's ready to go on a moment's notice.
Sure, and that happens a lot. I mean, it doesn't happen a lot, but, you know, you end up responding a lot that way.
Yes.
At times, right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And how many people usually go? Three or four?
Oh, it very much depends on the, you know, the size of the outbreak and the skills needed. So You know, it can be sometimes one person if it's a specific speciality that's needed for a small outbreak, and it depends. Or, you know, it can be many, many people, such as, you know, let's say it's happened with Haiti recently, or in Ukraine when Ukraine had its first H1N1 cases. So it's very variable.
We just had a couple. I'm just looking at a couple of questions that people had asked on the site for me to ask you, and I think we've pretty much gone through all those. People wanted to know, I guess, when was it, if you look at the outbreak in Mexico, when was your very first indication that this was a serious spreading event that you needed to respond to?
Well, what happened was basically we have outbreak meetings every morning here in Geneva, and we review the latest information that we get from the field, that we get from ministries of health, that we get from other sources, to ascertain how close a watch we should be keeping on this, what its potential is, et cetera, et cetera. And I can remember, let's say, probably for the whole month of April and maybe back as far as late March, seeing what was going on both north and south of the border, because, you know, at the same time there were the cases in California and then in Texas. And very clearly it was just one or two days before we actually got the confirmation from the labs and CDC in Winnipeg, in Canada, that if these things were actually connected, we were in for something big. But there was already the suspicion days earlier, because in Mexico what was happening was there were a lot of cases of respiratory illness occurring outside the normal influenza season. So it was on our radar.
Okay. Because I guess several different groups have all sort of said they found it first. And we're unaware of how quickly you guys really do get involved and how fast, you're aware of things that are happening.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing is that the more people who are aware of it, the better, you know, because the worst thing is to be taken by surprise. So if a lot of people are looking at it, great, and the more that we can help react quickly and get people, you know, in order to get people in place or have the proper actions taken, the better.
Mm-hmm. Supposedly, I think last year in France there was going to be a series of lab reassortment, I guess, experiments with H1 and N1 and H5N1. Are you familiar with any of those efforts or with the results of anything from that happening?
No, sorry, I'm not familiar with those.
There was a mention of it, I believe, in Nature magazine, but we're not aware of anything ever happening or coming of that at all. So I guess that would mimic what you're saying. We're not familiar with that. Thanks, Gregory, for everything. Is there anything that you'd like to say, you know, that who would like to say at this point before we end?
Yeah, thank you very much. I'd just like to reiterate once more that this is indeed a pandemic. There, in our minds, is no doubt about the fact that this is a worldwide transmission of a virus, of a novel virus, which is definition of a pandemic. And we have seen how this virus caused sometimes very severe illness and death in groups of people who normally aren't affected by influenza. And that's another sign of the fact that we are dealing with an unusual event here. So to say that we were influenced in any way by anyone outside the organization in our decision to go to phase six is wrong in our opinion. We were not unduly influenced. And if you remember, in fact, we actually waited for 6 weeks between the declarations of phase five and phase six. So we were actually very circumspect. And indeed, if you look back at what we said during the records of what we said in April and May, we were very clear that we felt that the majority of cases were mild and that there would only be occasional severe cases. And yet, again, we go back to the point that there are unusual groups affected by this disease and can be affected very severely by a viral pneumonia, which sometimes progresses very fast. So WHO was at pains to state these facts and also at pains only to move forward when we were sure of the scientific advice, or as sure as we could be in a changing situation. Of course, science was far from complete during that time, and we learn new things all the time, too. What's happening now is that we are a few days away from potentially going from phase six to the next phase, which is called post-peak. We will listen to what our emergency committee says on Tuesday, and we'll take advice accordingly. If we go to post-peak, it actually still means that we are in a pandemic. We are not out of the pandemic, but we expect overall activity to have declined. Nonetheless, we would continue at WHO to recommend the same measures as we have been recommending throughout, and that to the effect that vaccine is a very important tool, especially important for high-risk groups such as pregnant women, people with underlying respiratory conditions, and children. And we would highly recommend that those groups continue to get vaccinated, because vaccine is one of the best, if not the best, public health tool we have. There is no other consideration which has come into play in this instance, except for the fact that we want to save lives. That is our be-all, that is our end-all, and nothing else can motivate us, and if something else were to motivate us, then we would not deserve or merit the trust and credibility of the world. So we would continue, or will continue, to recommend, as long as we are not out of this pandemic, that countries continue to take measures to survey for potential outbreaks, to be prepared to treat potential outbreaks, and to continue to vaccinate high-risk groups. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for appearing with us today, and I hope the weather gets better for you there in Switzerland soon.
It definitely will.
Okay, thank you so much. Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.